Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Bennett. Each episode, we talk about the research and practical aspects of the trauma informed movement. This podcast is not designed to replace mental health services. If you feel uncomfortable or triggered by our discussion, please consider seeking your own trauma treatment. In no way is seeking treatment an admission of weakness. It is a chance to build resiliency and experience post-traumatic trauma. You can find show notes, resources, and more at traumainformedlens.org. Welcome, friends, to the Trauma Informed Lens Podcast. I'm Matt Bennett, and I'm here with my good friend, Shelly. Shelly, I had this realization. I saw you in the news here locally, and I realized that somehow, being such a dear friend of mine, being an inspiration to me, and I would say even a mentor in many ways in the field of homelessness, I haven't had you on the show yet. I think we have all these great conversations, and usually, immediately, I have folks on the show, and maybe I was doing that a little bit because I knew you were in a position where maybe you couldn't share as freely. Now you're out there sharing freely. So I am so excited, my friend, to have you. I can't wait to have a conversation about something I'm going to call theory of mind. I'll define that a little bit more, especially how it applies to trauma, which often leads to mental health issues behind your expertise with homelessness, housing, all those issues. And we'll end with some of the great work that you're doing. But for the listener who doesn't know you, my friend, please give us an introduction of who you are and a little bit about the work that you've done.
Okay, thanks, Matt. And I'm really excited to be here. So I can't believe you consider me of any sort of mentor. So my name is Shelly Cohen McKittrick, and I am currently working with as a contract support person to Colorado Village Collaborative and getting ready to launch an organization that called Solid Earth Communities that we'll talk about a little bit later. I have been working with folks who are not only traditionally but consistently marginalized in our society for the past 25 to 30 years, because I'm getting old, but that just means I've done it longer, and that means I've learned more.
Wisdom.
And I'm trying to, I think I'm at this point in my life where I'm trying to make sure I'm passing anything I've learned on, because I am hopefully getting toward being able to rest a little more. And I worked in the HIV epidemic, making sure that people had access to excellent treatment information and nutrition information and all of that for about 15 years. And now I've been working in homelessness. They both start with H. So
I know.
For what, I don't know, 5 years or so. I did the switch and bring the knowledge from this other, you know, siloed community over to this. And then they are very crossover.
Absolutely.
In so many ways.
Absolutely. Great. You know, so you've only been working in homelessness for 5 years?
Well, wait a minute. No, that's not right.
Because
I don't do math well.
I'm not saying anything bad about that, but
2012, 8 years.
Okay. I've known you working in that for a while longer than that.
I met you about 7 years ago.
Yes, so exactly. How time flies.
So actually, when I was working in HIV, you know, I felt like treatment had gotten to a point where it was so good that if you had access to healthcare, there was no longer an issue.
Right.
And I know this, you know, personally, because my husband is living with HIV and we've been together forever, and you know, old age is going to get him. Yeah. So I really wanted to move and dive into more, a little lower on the, or deeper in the core social issue layer of anti-oppression and anti-poverty and anti-racist work. And homelessness sort of became my next place to apply love, compassion, and intelligence and best practices.
And we were so fortunate here in the Denver metro area that you chose us, to come and provide that expertise. I know not your first stop in the metro area by any stretch, but to be a part of the work that you were doing here. We're just so lucky to have you. So it's so hard to measure lives saved and changed in our work because we're not doing CPR on folks. We're not doing surgery. But I know the impact you have is so far reaching. So it's well overdue for us to have this conversation. And
thanks for having me, Matt.
Yeah. And what I waking up and realize I hadn't had you on the show was one part, but there was a specific, thing that happened in our community. And it's something that I don't know we've ever talked about on the show. I know I mentioned it because it really informs my thinking. And one of the terminologies you will use to hear it is called theory of the mind. And I think we're going to use homelessness as sort of the way to structure our conversation about this topic. But I think when you look at a lot of the, what I like to call the symptoms of trauma, whether it's addiction, whether it might be unemployment, a range of mental health issues, there's a lot of judgment on those things, incarceration. And obviously, we know, having been in this field and being trauma nerds ourselves, is, try to find someone utilizing a homeless shelter in your community who hasn't come from a history of trauma. You probably, again, the exceptions to the rule always exist, but you might spend a while searching for that individual. So there is this judgment, and theory of the mind gave me a way to understand why, especially a lot of our policymakers, but I would also say our community members, our policymakers are just sometimes making the policies that you and I know can either make the problem better or make the problem worse. Is theory of mind talks about our natural psychological tendency to walk up by someone experiencing homelessness on the street and say, what do they need? But our answer to that question is, what would I need if I was in that position? And, that really helped me appreciate that my thinking about issues, and I always challenge myself to find different issues, and I watch the news and people I disagree with, sometimes I can find empathy there, but it's like, okay, but with the person experiencing homelessness, before I kind of got in this field, is, okay, well, I get off my butt, I would go to the library, I'd print off my, 20-page CV that I've literally created over the years. I take that down to wherever I had a job opening, because I also have searched for jobs online. I have a LinkedIn account. I put that in. I go to Starbucks because I know they have health insurance, deliver my. And so I was thinking of, it's really easy to say, Matt, get off your butt and go get a job. Now, when I started to learn about trauma, I realized, well, there's a biology, a neurobiology, which is expert at surviving there out on the street. Whereas if you put me in that position, that'd be a big T traumatic event for me, because I have no skills to survive out on the street. It would be overwhelming immediately to me. A history of struggles for a lot of folks academically and occupationally. In other words, there's not a 20-page CV necessarily to go print out, nor the confidence that I could walk in and get, much less maintain employment. And so one of the biggest issues, and why I just try to talk to trauma about every single person that will listen, is that the lack of understanding about who is sitting there on the street or in the shelter is a huge barrier to really addressing a lot of these issues, whether it is addiction. I mean, the crack epidemic was much earlier on in my career, how we treated that was just racist and horrible. But I also think we understood some of the problems too. Right. So this brings me to you, my friend, and an event where I saw you came across my Twitter feed. It's like, yes, because I've been commenting about this situation, and I'm just so glad you got in. more of the mainstream press instead of my Twitter feed with this. And so I would love for you to share a little bit as you feel comfortable too, but I know you've taken a really strong public stand on this, about kind of how you've seen this impact the work and maybe a specific scenario that we're dealing with here in the Denver metro area.
Sure. This is so what I didn't mention in introducing myself is that the last 4 years I was the homelessness program director at the city of Aurora, and I was the first person to hold that position. And
can I just for those that don't know the Denver metro area, right. I think Aurora is bigger than St. Paul, Minnesota. It's Denver itself is pretty small. Aurora is just this huge.
It's a sprawling suburb with its own very urban issues that are all its own as well. Our continuum of care for people that work in homelessness is a really large 5-county sprawling area. So I was in one of those large areas and actually worked for local government, which was, you know, a new experience for me and a stretch, and I learned a lot. And in the first few years, like almost any job that you get to create, there was a really awesome opportunity to go crazy. And I had marijuana funds to spend, which I think is the best practice as weed becomes decriminalized nationally, I hope, so that it actually stops criminalizing folks. And allows for the funding sources to be available, because millions and millions of dollars come into Colorado as a result of legal marijuana, and a lot of good is being done with that. So I think the issue that Matt is alluding to here is street homelessness and the way we continue to both raise the visibility and of those folks, as well as rendering those folks invisible. It is the most odd dichotomy. You're either invisible and trying to hide out, or be in whether it's a closet of one kind or another, immigration, LGBTQ, poverty, you can't hide when you no longer have a house. And yet no one wants to see you. So it's this really strange combination of things to experience. And before I came back to Colorado, I was in Santa Cruz, California. And in Santa Cruz, unsheltered homelessness is more like 70%, or in California in general, 70% of the population is unsheltered. And here it's flipped. It's more like a third of the population is unsheltered, which is good since we get very cold, but still. Denver has been handling street homelessness, where people are in tents and on benches and such, in their way, which I don't agree with. Hardly anyone that works within the homeless services arena would agree that moving people every 2 to 3 weeks is no way to help them get on their road to housing or anything that would create a fulfilling life for them. So there's living on the streets, there's getting told you have to move, there's all your really good stuff that you can't carry within the time frame that they told you that you had to move, that gets thrown in a dumpster, you have to go find all your equipment again, you maybe lost your meds in that, the stuff that happens during a sweep is unbelievable. And then out in Aurora, we had we didn't have a camping ban, which was part of the reason I went to work there, is that I felt good about that. But we still move people. So what happened was Mayor Kaufman, Mike Kaufman, who used to be a congressman in D.C. for Colorado, he's now the mayor of Aurora, decided to go underground and be homeless Mike. And he's a veteran of the Marines and, a long time veteran of Congress. He was very supportive of VA homelessness issues when he was in Congress. He seemed to be that he was going to be pretty mellow about carrying on the homelessness stuff when he got there. But in fact, he went underground and decided to pretend to be homeless for a week. I think it was a week.
Week 10 days, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it went 10 days. Those three extra days, it can make it really hard.
Yeah.
But in any case, he decided to dress up as a homeless vet and at least and go be disingenuous with people on the streets, which is absolutely not okay, you know, in my book. Secondly, he decided to not open up his lens and broaden his worldview of how humans experience trauma and realize that when he's faking who he is and asking, you know, why people are there, they're going to give him the, oh, you know, hey, I don't like the shelters because I can't drink. True that.
Yeah.
If alcohol is your medicine, or if, you know, whatever your self-medication of availability, I won't even say choice, of access of, is not allowed where you go to sleep safely and you've become addicted to that substance to manage your days, then you're not going to go to that shelter. Exactly. So you'd rather be outside, sleep in a tent. There you go. One answer for him. Anyways, he came out of that week not understanding anything, in my opinion, and he actually did more damage than any good in making people be seem more stigmatized or stigmatizing them more. He's got, you know, a certain amount of clout in communities that voted for him, and he's going to say these things that I worked for in Aurora for 4 years trying to undo these stigmas and stereotypes. And he went and just kind of threw them all back together at once and said that people are lazy. They like it on the street in a tent when it's 10 degrees out or zero or whatever. They don't want to go anywhere. They don't really want help. People bring them food. How could we possibly just bring them food? Because who needs food? So just talking about this, my anger gets riled up. And then when we start to talk, and that's why I got so animated on the press conference, because it's real on the people. So, you know, and then you add to that, the very people, why the mayor of Aurora decided to go to Denver to hang out with street homeless folks instead of going to our encampments that are more like out in fields or in a lot that hasn't been developed yet, or, you know, we have a little bit of tent homelessness that's cropped up over this last year more than ever, like in our urban areas. There's always folks sleeping on the street or in the parks, but actual tents haven't been around too much. And all that Mayor Kaufman managed to accomplish was to further stigmatize folks and probably change some of the policy that we've been working so hard to achieve, and that many of the members of Aurora City Council are working on. So, so you know, what's interesting is that this all kind of came down shortly after I'd left the city, and you know, trauma was a part of the reason I left. It started to become traumatizing for me to have to go to work and fight for people and for every little ounce of policy. And I was losing my effectiveness. So I think, you know, the shifts that we see in administrations and such, like we're watching right now in our country, thank goodness. They affect people's lives, and you know, right down to whether you're going to be able to stay in your tent.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other piece of kismet here is that I wound up my first gig outside of the city was to work with the Colorado Village Collaborative, the people here in Colorado who are doing safe outdoor spaces in tiny home villages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I've been able to see even more than ever before, because it's I ran low barrier shelters and lowered the barriers as much as possible, but there's nothing quite like offering somebody a tiny home with a locking door, community support, social services support, you know, and you don't have to pass any tests to get in. You don't have to prove you're a worthy human being to get in, because everybody's a worthy human being to this organization.
Yeah, and I want to explore that a little bit more with you, because I mean, the work that you did, I mean, the Kaufman scenario is just, a frustrating escalation because it became so public. You know, because I also, like, one of the things you did, and not that Matt's the answer to all these problems, but, you know, you brought me into Aurora to talk to city council members, you know, to talk to the elected officials, to give them that trauma-informed lens, and not that sitting through a 2-3 hour training of Matt's is going to change the world by any stretch, but like, yeah, I just wanted him to talk. I give me 20 minutes of your time, dude, before you go jump to all these conclusions without having the underlying knowledge. And I just, you know, hearing you talk to, it's like, and just being your friend, I know the fight that you were fighting. You know, there's a part of me that I know, I'll just admit to, I could not have done as long as you did. I just know that about myself. I would not. And you had this resiliency, you know, to stick with it. But you know, as you fought these battles, and were in many ways, and I know I'm not the only one that would say these words, incredibly successful in a sort of odd, not odd community, but a politically diverse, that's probably better language, community. We are Colorado. We have all the extremes, and Aurora kind of puts that all into one.
Yeah, Aurora's it, man.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, you go to Boulder, you get one thing, Colorado Spring, you know, you can usually, like, Aurora's just is everything. And how were, you know, I think my answer, because, you know, if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail, is, you know, try to train everybody I can to provide that. I feel like if you understand the person that you pass, your empathy and compassion build. And you're doing that. I know you're doing the educational piece of it as well. Maybe not as formally as I always did, sometimes as formally as I did. But when you sat with policymakers facing this, you know, theory of mind sort of mentality, even though I know you hit some frustrating walls, probably on a daily basis, if not multiple times a day, how were you able to have the success that you did with folks who came in with none of that understanding?
Right. Well, I think you alluded to my opening show in Aurora was Matt Bennett, and we created a symposium called Creating Healing Communities. And addressing homelessness. And, you know, I think one of the things that was successful is we had police and code enforcement and social services providers and county human services people, you know, people that, you know, don't necessarily greet people with the most trauma-informed lens, all come together.
Yeah, banks and businesses there too, which was great.
Yeah, businesses, thank you, business district. And with the only message that I wanted them to hear that day is that trauma causes homelessness and homelessness is traumatizing.
Which
has become sort of my tagline that I got from EJ Becker. And that point got through, and I actually, upon leaving, and I'm gonna tell you a story that I shared over and over with people to try and get them to break through their box that they put homeless people in, or people experiencing homelessness. I don't know why I get on like talks and then I go crazy with my language when I'm
I regress two decades of my language when I'm on a Zoom too.
But, you know, well, let me just cut to that. So one of the things that happened kind of accidentally and organically was I was sitting with one of our neighborhood groups. I'd been asked to come talk. It happens to be the neighborhood I live in, which was, and the chair of that meeting, that neighborhood group, was the wife of the former mayor who wouldn't let people say the word homeless when he was the mayor of Aurora. We don't have homelessness in Aurora. You know, this is back a little while. But so I was like, well, how's this going to go? And when I got there, I wound, you know, I had a PowerPoint. I was ready to go. I looked at the 10 to 12 people that came with only one under 65. And decided to put the paper and the PowerPoint down completely and just sit on the table and have a chat with them. And what I did, and I found it to be really successful for it, so I did it over and over again, is I said, so you know how you guys all feel about family homelessness and how horrible you feel that we have school-age children and younger sleeping in cars, sleeping in shelters, you know, couch surfing, not being able to stay in one school, all of those things. And you know how you feel about that? And they're like, oh, you know, really grab them, maybe talk about how that trauma is impacting their brain development, not like you, but in that really you know, casual way. And then when I've got them right where I want them, feeling compassionate for the kids, which is totally valid, of course.
Yes. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
I know. I say, so you know the old guy on the corner that you have to look at every day when you go to work and you just wish he'd disappear. You don't want to see that. He's lazy. He's a bum. He never did anything in his life. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he was that kid.
Yeah.
He was that kid that didn't get the intervention and help he needed then. And honestly, it helped me because I've been so focused on chronically homeless adults in Santa Cruz. We had family services and they were awesome, but ending chronic homelessness was my, and the chronically homeless families as well, was my passion and gig there. And it really helped me to use that analogy in order for me to be more engaged with family homelessness. So it actually taught myself at the same time that if we don't provide these interventions now for these kids, they're going to be our next generation. Yeah. And one of the things that led me to was a really robust eviction prevention program. So before I came to Aurora, I did not understand the necessity of the prevention side to, you know, to literally interrupt the cycle that leads children to be chronically homeless adults. And so that was my learning, one of my learning intersections in my work in Aurora, but it also helped to move people beyond.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to things like increasing the number of people that are allowed to live together in order to afford housing, you know, Aurora turned it down, even though they have a city council member who's only, the only reason she was housed much of the time as a child was because they could share, single parents could share how to survive. So, you know, some of our electeds can see this in their colleagues and hear these stories and still not be able to, you know, draw themselves into not being afraid of folks who have been beaten up their whole lives.
Yeah. You know? Well, that's such a, I mean, they're like, I can, the challenge of trauma-informed, whatever, lens, care, school, what happened to you? And like, I challenge myself and I try to find someone that I'm yelling at, maybe on the news, and I ask that question. And, you know, sometimes it gives me more compassion and patience to listen to what they're saying. Sometimes I just continue to yell at the screen, but I try to bring that lens onto most things, at least when I'm regulated in my life. And, you know, and this is a little bit of a sidebar, but it's the people that I feel should know better. And I didn't add brain space for the guy's name, but it was a rare Republican senator that came out of Massachusetts at one point. I think he only had one term. And I just remember he was on 60 Minutes. I think he was famous for posing nude at one point. You know, one of those weird things of course, if you're going to get elected as a Republican conservative, and like, he was in a transitional living program coming out of foster care. And I'd run those programs. So, I mean, obviously dear to my heart, and he was cutting funding for these programs. And they asked him on 60 Minutes, is like, what were you? And it's like, well, we just don't have the money. And I'm like, you know, so even for me, I'm like, I think that's like, those are the hardest for me. But then I step back and I'll be very general with this comment, but I think it's a pretty safe one for everybody involved is, we were talking about a very, community-based program. And that the clients, the participants of this program basically had a lot of power in that community. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, what we saw was it became very one sort of race was becoming dominant, some of the things that are our inherent values to us, all of a sudden things, and I always found that they're always a lot stricter on each other than we would be. So it's like even in that microcosm, all of a sudden you saw, and I think a model I totally support of really empowering folks, yes, that there needed to be a intervention to some extent, and conversations had. Do you have any I know you faced that quite a bit, and that example is really powerful for me.
It's a very powerful example. I think, and you can correct me by neurobiologically if I'm wrong. I'm not going to get all geeky. I was the HIV treatment geek, so I don't have to do that twice. Yeah.
Don't ask me about the HIV life cycle. Neurobiology.
Don't have the brain space. It's fascinating to see people who have lived extremely traumatized lives. Oftentimes, I think, just really dig into whatever isms they might have grown up around or never been exposed to, whatever. But we do find a lot of homophobia, transphobia, racism, in within the homeless community, yeah, just like we do everywhere else. And right. And like I think I might have said on the news conference, but I say all the time, people are addicts everywhere. We just see the people who don't have a house to hide under.
Yeah.
Did you like that? That
I do.
That the way more drug use is going on inside of homes than outside of homes.
Right.
And if you were having to sleep in a tent that was going to get kicked or, disturbed during the night, or you were in a park and a woman alone for the first week of your time without a house, yeah, because you fled domestic violence or any of these other things, are you going to be able to sleep through the night? Are you going to be, you're either going to be hypervigilant, which everybody always is, and maybe start using drugs that help you stay up all night. So it could start with really strong cup of coffee. Seriously, coffee to, whatever anybody has next that can allow you to not wind up getting raped or not wind up getting beaten up or robbed. And I like to say those words really out loud because it happens to people every damn night, Matt. Every night people are harmed on the street, and every day people are harmed on the street. And for anybody to walk by those folks and think that there was a childhood dream that's where that person wanted to land, is they're off their rocker. It makes me want to cry right now. Those folks had dreams. Those kids had dreams that were squashed or interrupted. Their parents died. I mean, not all trauma comes from abuse. Right. A lot of trauma comes from life happening and, shit happening and not knowing if you're going to have enough food, which we have a ton of right now going on in our country, and not knowing where you're going to sleep. And do you have to go to school from a car and all of those things? So they get to be grownups, and we all get to be grownups, and we bring, we either bring what we have rebelled against to our adult life and where we've really worked, or we bring, what we grew up with. And I'm like the luckiest person on earth that I grew up with these really progressive parents, and I never felt the need to rebel against that because why would I? But, but a lot of folks don't grow up in that. So I entrenched into my upbringing just as much as I see folks get entrenched into other things. And we have racism within and unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. So what happened in this particular program is that the residents of the program who had come directly from the street had an opportunity to be choosing to be very involved, if not in charge of choosing the next residents that would come into this program. And that was, really, really meeting people in their power and giving them, the authority to make decisions about their own community. And what wound up happening is that the community that they were in became whiter and whiter over a few years. As each person of color left, it would get replaced with a white person. And so the organization didn't, that wasn't cool. And so what they did is look at the system that they had created that was almost fully in control of the client's hands, to looking at how they can do initial screenings and initial interviews so that who they're offering on the platter of choices of future residents yeah. are already going to create a diverse community.
Yeah.
And a funny story is that I heard after you were with me at this place is that one of the people interviewed for a placement in the project, they didn't have video capabilities. Yeah. They were just on the phone. The residents on the committee loved this person. And when she showed up, they were shocked because she was Black.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, they hadn't seen her. So they were like, she's so cool. Would she have been selected had yeah. they had a video camera? Who knows? So there are times when, you know, an organization with a mission and a solid anti-racist grounding are going to look at how they can change that system just a little bit so that equity and inclusion is built into the formula.
Yeah.
Without taking all power away from the current residents. And it's a fascinating thing. It can be really ugly, you know, if you're a Black trans woman getting beat up on outside the shelter you were trying to get a bed in. If yeah. you know, even in Santa Cruz, we had some horrendous racism going on at our shelter.
Yeah.
And it became potentially violent. And so, you know, being able to draw those lines, being able to draw the lines on hate speech for folks who haven't been given the boundaries that, you know, we grow up going, well, you can't say that word in public, even if you feel it. Sometimes you have to draw lines that just say, this isn't acceptable.
Yeah.
And then you have to create programs that keep the most vulnerable safe.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, drawing boundaries around racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and all those things. Obviously, there's always lines. The only line that usually a really low barrier trauma-informed organization would have is no violence.
Yeah.
Like, don't hit other people, don't strangle.
Yeah.
You know, I think threats are a whole different thing that through a trauma-informed lens, you need to sit down and say, you know, and go through that, or why is that what came up for you?
Right.
You know, what did that trigger for you? Like your big tallness and your deep voice and your story. You know, I got punched in the face in New York once when I was going on an outreach tour, just because I must have triggered this little yeah. lady to think I was her old sister or something that she ate the water out ball. She didn't know who she was hitting. That wasn't a reason to fire a client. That was a reason yeah. to say maybe your meds need adjusting.
Right, exactly. but it takes like it, and that's the thing. Like I'm fascinated. You know, from the, and I don't have to even talk about the brain to do this, but one of the things Daniel Siegel, as an author, talks about the rigid response, and that we become very, the more stress we're under, and obviously trauma being the most intense form of stress we can, and knowing homelessness is a trauma, you know, is that we become very rigid. And so the flexibility to think about, oh, you know, and we probably, you know, I think sometimes miss the training opportunities is like, hey, if we're going to hand over who's in the program, are they going to get the same training that our staff would in diversity
exactly. And
other, like, you just can't give power without the 101 that we give the new staff kind of walking in who made that decision previously. So that rigidity, but then we take that, and I'm always fascinated with, like, you know, I'm not going to get on this too, but I just think it's another example of prison gangs. Like all of a sudden you go to, I would argue the least rehab oriented environment you could possibly create if you tried,
right.
But you go in that environment, all of a sudden, how do we divide? We have divide immediately upon the most identifiable difference of a them and us dichotomy. And so when we're in that survival state, without insight, support, even training, that's kind of that, unfortunately for human beings, that default response.
Right.
But here's, I want to kind of bring us back though, using, I think this was a great lead in, is one of my biggest frustrations, and it doesn't stop me. It actually is a big motivator for me. So when I say frustrating, it's a barrier that I'm trying to find different ways to crawl, climb, right. dig under, is that I believe that people that often vote in ways, think in ways, act in ways that make homelessness worse, that take away funding, that don't believe these people have enough value to deserve basic human rights, mm-hmm. are also some of the most faith-based, religious folks as well. And, you know, we've lost our capacity. I'm going to make a statement. I'd love to get your thought, because you are in the trenches every day. I just go visit the trenches and try to yell as loud as I can occasionally. Hey, we share values. Let's just stereotype everybody. Take me as a progressive humanist, whatever that means, and an evangelical conservative Republican Christian, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. Don't we, as I say, did you read the New Testament? And we share these values, but yet we've lost the ability to say, hey, how do those, let's work together. Can we take homelessness out of this political divide? Because we're on the same, at least the person you worship has kind of given you a directive, more so maybe powerful than any other directive except love. But if you're going to apply that to everybody. And so I kind of wonder, as you, and we can get out of religion and back into politics, but as folks that we know are good people, I don't think when you get to know them, I got them in my family, just because they vote differently than me doesn't mean they're horrible people.
Right.
You know, and you were successful with it. So how did you, and I know your success came with a lot of frustration of running up against that wall too, but I do, I look at you as incredibly successful, and that you did it for 4 years was 2 years longer than I could have done it. How were you able to find those shared values to create motivation? Because you revolutionized a system in many ways. And so how are you successful? What advice would you give me to do better at running into my walls?
Yeah. And you know, for me being an ex Jew religiously, you know, so
I was born Catholic, so nobody needs to worry that we don't beat ourselves up.
Recovering Jew, very much, you know, I had my own internalized stuff around that I've overcome, and yes. really, you know, and it took a long time, but I am also an anthropologist, so I should have been able to take that on. Yeah, so actually being a cultural anthropologist by training has been really, really effective for me. So in those spaces where I don't feel comfortable, so because there I'm running up against my very core values and what I stand for. And for me, a lot of times churchy spaces are that for me. They're very uncomfortable and rub against me. And it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, I should say places of worship, because, you know, I'm not only focused on certain religions when I say I get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because I've chose to put that aside and live by my values, regardless of whatever happens after we're dead. Yeah. This is how I'm going to behave. And it doesn't change because of what I believe, mm-hmm. In a deity or not, but because I value human life and all of that stuff. Anthropologists do something called participant observation. So when I can be centered and conscious enough and be in those rooms, I can separate a little bit from my individual self, who doesn't really want to be in a space where religion is the core reason why people are gathered together, and become more observant of what's the dynamic that's happening in the room. And then and just emotionally separate a little bit so that I can be an observer and not just a participant.
Yeah.
And so that's been helpful, but also finding the person in the community that can be, or the people in your community that can be that bridge to for me to walk over. And so I found my folks who were very involved in communities of faith, and also shared my values to the point where I saw that they were enacting their religious values in a true form of serving the poorest and most marginalized among us. So when you find those folks that are doing, that are walking the talk and not really talking very much at all, they're just doing, then I allowed those folks to be my ambassadors for me into more uncomfortable spaces. And it really worked. You know, Brian Arnold was one of those people, is one of those.
I just talked to our friend the other day, actually.
And there are a few other people, Sean Sikkema, who runs Jesus on the on Colfax. Who would have known that, you know, I wound up feeling like their work was some of the best outreach that was being done. Because they'll just sit with people and listen and be with them and love them, you know? And I just kind of motivated them to also get them on the path to housing. Like, this is all good. This could be in love and whole, but just like, let's get them connected to services so that they're out of that motel or off of that street. Then it's just, there's nothing lovelier than working with people that go to work from their heart. But, and then, you know, you bring up the voting and I, you know, I think not to necessarily dive into our current national political situation, but I did see Jason Kroll yesterday being interviewed a few times on the news, our representative from Colorado. Jason, voted for him. Really talking so eloquently about trauma and as a veteran. And I was like, oh my God, he's going to teach Congress about trauma. He's going to show them that, you know, you know, how trauma works and how they can put that experience into action in their work. You know, like he did. And I'm encouraged that I think trauma is becoming a more consistent conversation in the mainstream world. And I hope that that leads to folks being able to stop themselves on the street and say, why am I judging this person? Like what you said, what happened? And if Mike Kaufman or if Mayor Hancock, if either of those mayors would go sit on a street bench with somebody and say, tell me about your life. What happened to you? Where were you born? You know, did Mike do any of that? I'll guarantee you he never said, tell me how this happened, what happened to you? And all he did is say, why are you here? So you're going to get a trauma brain telling this person who has disingenuous intentions, in my opinion, maybe not disingenuous intentions, but at least a misguided attempt to understand people completely. And never asked, tell me about your childhood. What happened to you? You know, probably why couldn't he ask those questions? Because he would have wound up outing himself, because you can't have a deep conversation and be a fake person. You know, putting on a front. I didn't mean to call him a fake person. You know what I mean? He was acting a role at that time. It wasn't real, which is automatically going to be felt by the people if you get into a deeper conversation. So he never got to their trauma. You know, those same people jump, I don't mean exactly the same, but the same areas downtown jumped at the opportunity to move from their encampment that was getting moved all the time into the safe outdoor space, winter ice tents that have finally been set up. These are solutions. You know, solutions to street homelessness are first to give people the sense of safety so that they can get a good night's sleep. You know, there's nothing more powerful than when somebody walks up to you and said, that's the best night's sleep I've had in 10 years. That is, and then you go, well, no wonder she lifts her skirt in peace in the street. She hasn't slept in 10 years. You know, I mean, like, can you imagine? I'm an absolute wild animal if I haven't gotten enough sleep and it goes past a week, you know, and I don't crash at some point to catch up. So
I can't get a good night's sleep in a hotel bed. How white privileged is that?
That's
pretty white privileged. And I mean, it's my reality. I have troubles and I would like really pay someone to fly me somewhere safely and let me sleep in a hotel bed right now. But you know, when I traveled a lot, I had trouble, you know, and again, so I like, from my perspective, it's like, what drugs would I need to go to sleep outside on.
I already know what my weaknesses are, you know. By the time you hit 61, you can kind of figure out where you might go. And you know, the problem is all those things are available like this, anywhere you are. And, you know, and then the other issue that at the other end of that is a problem is that, you know, traditionally, historically, we made people then start to fix themselves before they came into our systems at all. Right. And, you know, so luckily most of that has been thrown away.
Yeah.
However, I fear, you know, I fear that we can lose ground at any given moment.
Yeah.
You know? And people are not being asked to change in order to walk through the door. Yeah. But you can't change when you're in the situation that's causing you trauma. And I know you talk about that all the time, but you know, this is the reality. When you don't know if your tent's going to be there when you come back from maybe trying to apply for a job, or what is going to be gone from your tent, or whether or not it got thrown in a dumpster by a cop, you know, you're not going to be able to present yourself at an interview. Never mind all the technical practical ones of where you can shower, get cleaned up, and all that stuff.
Yeah,
that stuff is the stuff we're pretty good at providing solutions for. We have day resource centers. We can help you get spiffed up to go get your job. But if you can't work till 2 a.m. and still be able to go into your shelter bed because it's after the hours that they allow people to come in, and then you'll lose your job because you don't have a place to sleep. Like, all of these things are almost impossible to change from the street.
Yeah.
And when people are from the unsupported street, but a safe outdoor space in a heated tent, you know, you don't have to build great big new congregate spaces in order to get people into safety, security, a little less hypervigilance, let that cortisol drain out a little bit, you know, day after, you know, instead of coming back every day, the cup is not always full anymore. They can have a little space to breathe and that, what do you call that space you talk about? And that space opening up.
Window of tolerance. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, that starts to grow. One of the people at CBC who I adore that I work with, Quica Montoya, just mentioned that somebody that wasn't a resident at the Safe Outdoor Space got frustrated and hit her. And she said, it was a triumphant moment for me because I didn't hit back.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was her first experience of having that window of tolerance to be able to be the person that, you know, that set the boundaries and breathed as the leader of the
That's awesome.
Space. And
awesome in its own neurobiological way.
Totally awesome.
But not being hit. You know, but we've all been hit. Yeah.
You know, and that lady couldn't access those services anymore for that reason, but it was all understood in as a moment of trauma and you know, fight instead of flight. And so, you know, this all leads to the importance of not leaving people to languish on the streets without real opportunities to engage in getting their life back on the track they want to be on. And it's, you know, I've never heard somebody start to dream that doesn't have an awesome idea of something they'd like to, even if it's just taking a bath with bubbles,
right?
Even if that's the dream, is a bath and a bubble bath. And so, you know, I decided when I left the city, I'm helping a segue because I'm looking at the time. Are you proud of me?
Now, let me ask you one more question, because I want to give you to talk about the great work that you're doing.
Ask me
One of the things that frustrated me about Homeless Mike and that thing is, one, everything we've talked about. And I went to kind of a dark place here, and then I got myself back because I was like, okay, here is a mayor of a large part of a metropolitan area, but Aurora is huge if you haven't been out to Denver property.
Almost 400,000 people.
Yeah, it's a huge metropolitan area. Yeah, exactly. And I was like, here is someone, let's be strength-based for a second, that spent a whole week trying to understand homelessness. And we both agree, went about it all wrong. I thought about, though, that, like, okay, if Mike would have come to me, one, I would not have himself label himself Homeless Mike. But, you know, besides that, it's like, because initially I was thinking about what kind of cocktail I would want him to shoot, you know, to inject in his bloodstream to understand what addiction was like. That was my first dark place I went. And then I was like, maybe I shouldn't be injecting our elected officials with my made up personal cocktail of trauma. But I was like, what would you, because you were in this position and I'm almost, not that anybody came to you do this, how would have you constructed that 7 days? And, you know, I know I'm just throwing the drop question at you, like, without any warning, but I would love, you don't have to be like day by day, minute by minute, but what would be, because I think sleeping out on the street is good. I also like what some of my friends in Fort Collins, north of Denver do. They don't even let people do the camp out thing, but then they make them go to appointments the next day on the public transportation line, which I think is a great addition for empathy. But again, not the full experience by any stretch, but another real frustration with that. So if you were to craft, let's just call him Mayor Mike instead of Homeless Mike, which I at that point he had lost me before I even read what he did. But how would you craft 7 days of a good experience where maybe an elected official who is maybe voting in ways that makes the problem worse gets at least a better understanding of who they're trying to serve? And because I think he's trying to help.
I think his intentions were good. He's not an evil person or anything.
No. And we need to make sure on our side, we don't jump to our rigidity and say,
he just stops trying. You know, I would have appreciated it if he'd have come to me when I was still there, because I very likely was still there when he was planning this or thinking about it, or come to the, you know, anyone else in the homeless services community, the new person they've hired, and say, I'm thinking about doing this. I'd appreciate it if you would keep it confidential for now. But what would you recommend I do? This is what I would have said.
Yeah.
I would have said, don't lie about who you are.
Yeah.
Lying to people isn't cool.
Yeah.
It's really not cool. I would have said, be as genuine as you can and introduce yourself to folks and say you'd like to be able to hang out with them for a few days in their encampment and hear about their lives and what led them to being here. And then hang out, sit around the campfire and don't say the cops or the fire department's going to come, you know, like, and, you know, and do it in the city you're trying to work on that you are the mayor of, maybe. It really didn't make sense that he did all of this in Denver when we have our own really entrenched chronic homelessness right here in Aurora. Colfax Avenue is full of wounded hope. It's just, you know, so I would have just asked him to be sincere, genuine, honest, and shut up and listen. Which I'm pretty sure he did listen, you know, but he listened by asking questions, pointed questions. You know,
and lying about who you are. And I think the thing that pops into my head after I created my own traumatizing addiction cocktail, I thought about he should inject it himself. Well, once I calmed down my own negative response to the situation, I was like, how powerful and rare would it have been if he spent not even a week, but a couple days, even a couple hours, even listening to folks as the mayor, like, you know, just taking a city council member with him or two and going and doing just, I wouldn't call them focus groups per se. They didn't need to be that, but just like going and having legit one-on-one conversations, legit group conversations, getting a little bit of education to ask, understand. I would have loved to have had that up front. So, you know, kind of who you're talking to, not that you want to just judge them prematurely, but here's the other dynamics and the complexity of this issue, because that's like a thing is these folks, as you mentioned in the intro, are so invisible. What potentially a life-changing moment for everybody in the room including if you asked me to facilitate, I don't know how I wouldn't cry if that was going on. Like, I would not be the right person. You'd want to get like a focus group person who wouldn't cry during it. But like it just like, it's like you never heard and you never understood. And it's like, oh, just give me even a day, even like a day to educate and then listen, and how different that experience could have been.
I think it's a little bit like folks who travel and stay at the all-inclusive. I'm not being judgmental because we did that once when we went, and it's like, well, this really is easy. Just kind of didn't have enough money on that trip. It was cheaper to do the all-inclusive and eat there. But that's kind of like that kind of traveling, which is not my idea of really traveling. Even on a vacation versus renting a house and embedding yourself in the community, even if it's for 2 weeks or a year or 6 months, and really diving in, you know. So I think the anthropologist in me, who is always working in the anti-oppression space, always, always looking in, looking at things like apartheid in South Africa and unequal access to healthcare here and things like that. The anthropologist in me automatically wants to hear people's stories, but I think a lot of us have it. As soon as you open it up, first off, people need to share their stories and get them out, not in that rote, as you said, one intake after another, so that the person says, can I swear on this show?
Oh yeah, go for it.
I don't want to have to fill in another fucking intake, I think.
Yeah. way to quote me with your cussing. Yeah.
But anyways, to really, truly and genuinely listen. And, we have an interesting thing I've observed in the last year or two is I used to do the VI Spadats in Santa Cruz as a provider quite a bit. And VI Spadats are the vulnerability index that have helped us over the last several years decide who's the most likely, to not survive on the street and need the housing the most quickly. And what's really interesting when people leave this straight off the street, pack their backpack and come into a tiny home at Colorado Village Collaborative. And then if they don't get, we turn it into a verb, VI Spadatted. within the, first month or two of being there, hopefully within the first month, then you're going to see their vulnerability scores just drop. And so the reason I found out was because they were, the staff was conducting some initial VI Spadats on folks who had been in the tiny home village for a couple of years. And I had met those folks and I expected them from what I had gathered about what kind of level of housing intervention they needed, that they would fall into the permanent supportive housing category. Yeah. And yet they were scoring on the low end of rapid rehousing. Well, why? Because the questions are, have you had involvement with the police over the last 6 months? Have you had to go to the hospital in an ambulance? Have you all of these street emergencies that had stopped happening in their lives? And all of it, so, the importance of getting those assessments as people, because they're still going to be challenged with their chronic trauma and length of time out of the workforce and all of those challenges, getting past the felony because you're a Black woman and the white woman in the shelter sitting next to you didn't get a felony for the same thing you got a felony for, and now you can't get an apartment. And, you really want to see me get mad. We go there another time. We need people need time to heal, but we also need to accurately assess their level of trauma and need at their most vulnerable, so that when over the long haul, they get the intervention they need in housing. Absolutely. And we can back it off as the healing happens,
There's a return on investment in this. And I know those come from, the hard things, they come from different pots of money. So they may not show up in the same fiscal year as the investment is made, but there's a freaking return on investment too. All right, let's wrap up. You're doing some amazing work. Just because you left the city of Aurora doesn't mean you haven't stopped with our shared passion of ending homelessness. I know multiple things going on right now, but tell folks, maybe if you could throw a web address or two, we'll put some information in the show notes, but maybe for just the listeners, some easy access to you. But what great work are you doing now?
Well, thank you. And it really is this segue from talking about being on the street or in a tiny home or a shelter, if that works for you, which is great. I love shelters when they work for folks. And how do we get folks into the housing that they need, that is trauma informed in its both its design and its application of supportive services. And one of the, you know, we have a lot of need for density, housing density, and in our cities, because there's a lot of folks that need housing, but an apartment in a high rise isn't going to necessarily be the best fit for everyone. And you know, why do we think that we can have one type of housing as a solution for everybody that has experienced housing instability? You know, that doesn't even have to be a straight up literal homelessness. And so I am working with a group called Solid Earth Communities. Previously, they were known as Earth and Blocks Homes. Still, that still exists, but basically we're gonna be building compressed earth homes out of dirt and hemp and, you know, mud, but then they get compressed and dried in the sun and become as solid as any fired brick, but they weren't fired. So there's the carbon emissions of making the houses is much lower. The walls are a foot thick. So they wind up being soundproof, waterproof, bulletproof, which in some urban communities, just knowing, even if you're not living there anymore, if you've been in neighborhoods with drive-bys and lost a bunch of your family members, knowing your home is bulletproof is not a bad thing. But in any case, we're going to be building communities, not just sporadic homes. And so what we really want to do is build casitas that folks who want a single family home with detached walls because they feel more secure in that, or because they want a garden, or because they want to live in community, they can have that in a way they never would have been able to imagine for less than the price of building an apartment because of these construction materials. And then over the long haul, the maintenance of the building is very low because it's earth. And it's not going to go anywhere. And these buildings last forever and ever, like hundreds and hundreds of years. So that's what I'm doing. The website is really easy. It's solidearthcommunities.org. And my email is Shelley with an EY at solidearthcommunities.org.
Awesome. So,
you know, I'm really excited about that. I think all of us need to switch up what we do every once in a while. I needed a little space from all the politics and the direct service, although I'm really enjoying being back in that direct service world a little bit. So I just think it's going to be awesome to be a creator of spaces that are trauma-informed in their design, in the material they're constructed of, in the having a front and a back door in case people have this need to have a place to flee, and being able to have a little garden space, even if it's only a 350 square foot home. Awesome. You know, it's really exciting to think about creating a home for folks that isn't in a high rise. I love the high rises. We need them. This is a different offering altogether.
Yeah. Awesome. And I love someone who's tries to, you know, eliminate my carbon footprint as much as possible. I think often we don't take into account the environmental costs of construction. And you hit me on two fronts there.
I know, it's so awesome. It's like, I've had all these conflicts in my work that I've had to be, you know, with my work here. And now it's like, well, there's not an environmental conflict. It can be trauma-informed. I'm really not having a lot of conflict right now. So that's
awesome. Well, hey, it's a great place to end up. My friend, I just want to thank you as someone who lives in the community, not right in Aurora, but like I said, it's the metro area. I want to thanks for all the hope, all the work, which, you know, I know was a like pushing that boulder up the hill, but we are better as a community because you did that amazing work. And I'm really excited to see where this innovation goes next. And I hope a lot of people are very interested and will reach out. We'll put the information in the show notes as well as trauma-informed lens. Org. So thank you, my friend. I gotta have you back. I can't go several years without you coming back to the show.
Let's talk about equity and race next time.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe who knows when this community's built. Maybe it'll be the first. I guess we have been on the road with this podcast once or twice, but we'll save that for the future as well. So
okay.
Thank you so much, and I'll see everybody next week.